We are a touch before 10:50, but attorneys, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I think we'll go ahead and get started then. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Tuesday, March 8th, 2022, and this is our final case on the oral argument docket today. These arguments are recorded by the court, and the audio recordings of the arguments are generally available within 24 hours on the Court of Appeals page at the Judicial Branch's website. I just want to note that the appellate rules prohibit anyone from making a recording, audio, or video of an oral argument unless they have received advance permission from the court by at least 24 hours, and they have agreed to comply with the specific conditions established by the Minnesota Supreme Court. With that, Marshall, please call the case before us now.
This final case is A21-1551, State of Minnesota versus Jason Randolph Christensen.
Counsel, as you are probably aware, you each have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you look at your screen, there is a clock in the upper left-hand corner that will count down your time. It'll be reset for the beginning of each argument. At the beginning of your presentation, please introduce yourself so that the recording here today is clear, and please mute yourself when you're not speaking and identify who you represent. Finally, if you have any difficulties with the technology, please let me know right away and we will try and do what we can to address that for you. We want to make sure we hear from each of you. So with that, counsel for appellant, please begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is attorney Drew Hushka and I'm representing appellant Jason Christensen in this matter. This appeal presents the court with two issues, either of which would require reversal of the district court's order. The first issue is whether or not law enforcement had dispelled reasonable suspicion at the time they seized the appellant, Mr. Christensen. The second issue is whether or not law enforcement afforded Mr. Christensen a proper opportunity to consult with counsel prior to submission to a chemical breath test. Now, the facts of this case are largely undisputed and are subject to verification based on the two recordings that were submitted into evidence at the suppression hearing in this case. At approximately 9:22 p.m., Trooper Holden received a dispatch for an automated alarm system saying that there was a broken window at Beverage Wholesalers in Detroit Lakes. He responded to the dispatch and arrived at the location approximately 2 minutes after the dispatch. Now, as shown in the video recording, at the time he arrived, the garage to Beverage Wholesalers was open and a figure was walking out of the garage empty-handed. There was also a keg on the ground behind an SUV, and the back of the SUV was open. Trooper Holden could also observe that no windows at this location had been broken. Based on these observations, he audibly mused, and it's caught on the recording, that it appears that this is a worker of Beverage Wholesalers. Nevertheless, he still activates his overhead lights in this private parking lot, approaches the figure who is the appellant, Mr. Christensen. Mr. Christensen stops and raises his hands in a showing of submission to the show of force. We argue that at that point, a seizure had been made and that seizure occurred after this dispelling of reasonable suspicion.
Subsequently, so if I can jump in, Mr. Hushka, I mean, we do have cases where there is a period of time where officers are conducting an investigation and gathering information and then making a decision based on that. As I look at this case, how long would you say that, would you term the pre-seizure investigation last? Because it seems pretty simultaneous as the lights are on. It seems that the seizure is pretty simultaneous. So what period of time are we talking about?
Your Honor, I would agree that the period of time is brief in this case, but I do not believe that the doctrine of dispelling reasonable suspicion relies temporally on anything. I think if it's dispelled within 5 seconds, I think that can happen. If it takes 10 minutes to dispel reasonable suspicion, I don't think timeliness is at issue. Instead, it is when the officer had dispelled reasonable suspicion in his mind, and then if the seizure occurred before or thereafter. In this case, both in the transcript, and I'm quoting from page 21, lines 12 through 16, Question, at the time you approached, did you dispel that you believed that someone was breaking into the business at that point? Answer, when I went to speak with him, I believed it was probably just a false alarm. End quote. And so in his testimony and both in the recording, when he audibly muses that this is just a worker and that there's no broken windows visible, which is what the report was, we would argue that at that point, reasonable suspicion was dispelled. And as the video indicates, when he muses, that was dispelled prior to the seizure, prior to the activation of the overhead lights. And so we would argue that, again, reasonable suspicion had been dispelled prior to any seizure in this case, and therefore the seizure was unreasonable. Now, we're not
again, saying, if I could ask it very pointedly, how much time do you think we're talking about in this case?
In this case, I think it was probably only a matter of seconds from when it actually had been dispelled versus when the seizure occurred. I agree it happened in very close proximity, but taking Trooper Holden at his word and his testimony and in his own audible musing on the recording, it did occur before the seizure in this case.
So the next question that I guess I have is about that statement on the recording as well as in the transcript, and whether or not you believe that means that a reasonable officer would just drive away at that point?
No, Your Honor. And I believe we tried to address this in our reply brief, and that I think a reasonable officer in this position would still likely arrive at the scene and get out and indeed confirm that there was not a crime going on. And we argue that that's what Trooper Holden could have done. He could have simply approached, he could have parked, he could have gotten out his vehicle and had a consensual encounter with Mr. Christensen. What's at issue in this case and why we're arguing it's a Fourth Amendment violation is that there was not a consensual encounter, that it instead was a seizure because of the activation of the overhead lights and elsewise. We would concede that a reasonable officer still would likely want to confirm this and say that, yes, this was a worker and that their assumption was correct. And they can do that, and they can do that in a consensual encounter, which law enforcement is allowed to do with or without reasonable suspicion. But that is not what happened in this case. Again, there was the activation of the overhead lights and there was a legal seizure then at that.
All right, but that goes back to my first question, because it seems like the activation of the overhead lights occurs prior to the statement on the recording, for example. So basically all you're saying is that 2 second, 1 second, split second amount of time, at that point, a reasonable officer turns off the lights and sort of undoes whatever indicia of investigative seizure had been taken.
I would say that, Your Honor, I guess I my recollection of the video is different. Obviously, the video is part of the record and the court is able to review and see when those lights go on versus when the statement is made and can make that determination for itself. But to the extent that the statement comes slightly after the statement would made, I guess I would say that, yes, at that point, the officer should deactivate the overhead lights, should release the seizure and then continue a consensual encounter between himself and Mr. Christensen to as it relates to anything and to suspicion. Again, because it's undisputed that the keg was outside, Mr. Christensen was walking out of the building empty-handed, and that there were no windows broken. All of this was observable to the officer as they were pulling into the parking lot. Again, I don't think alcohol facilities are burglarized to have kegs returned in the middle of the night. At that point, there is simply no reasonable officer would believe that there was a crime afoot of returning a keg through an open garage window at the middle of the night. Now, if Mr. Christensen had been walking out with a keg in his hand or with merchandise or with something like that, that's a different situation. There's potentially reasonable suspicion in that case. But here, the observation of the officers made it clear that Mr. Christensen was simply returning merchandise to the to his employer, to the warehouse at that time. And so, again, this was not a long investigation. It was not a detailed investigation, but the very limited observations made by the officer, even at that point, confirmed quite correctly that this was not an ongoing burglary. This was not an ongoing breaking and entering. And because there had been a dispelling of that reasonable suspicion, Trooper Holden acted unreasonably in seizing or in continuing to seize Mr. Christensen after that suspicion had been dispelled. If there aren't any further questions, I guess, on the seizure argument, I would transition to our attorney time argument. Seeing none, I will go on. Again, the facts on this are also largely undisputed and are verified by the recording Exhibit 2 that was entered into evidence at the suppression hearing. So from approximately 9:47 to 48, Trooper Holden reads Mr. Christensen the Minnesota breath test advisory. Mr. Christensen then says that he wants to speak with an attorney. And then from approximately 9:49 to 9:50, he is given his phone and he twice tries to call his father to facilitate contact with an attorney. At 9:51, he calls another number that is not identified in his call log. We would say that it is the attorney from the number in the directory, but that's unsuccessful. At 9:52, he again tries to contact someone else. Trooper Holden asks if Jason's still trying to contact someone. He says yes. 9:53, he tries to contact his father again. That call fails. From 9:53 to 9:57, he speaks with his stepmother again to try to get contact with his father to facilitate contact with an attorney, a local attorney that knows them through that. At 9:59, Trooper Holden advises Mr. Christensen that if he is not personally trying to contact an attorney, he's going to terminate the attorney contact time. Mr. Christensen explains that he's trying to get in touch with his father because his father has many local contacts with attorneys and he wants to speak to someone that knows him or that they're familiar with. From 9:59 to 10:03, he tries to call his father two more times. 10:04, he tries to call his stepmother one more time. And at 10:05, he finally succeeds in reaching his father. He speaks with his father from 10:05 to 10:06, and his father agrees to help facilitate contact with a known attorney. He hangs up at 10:06 and immediately informs Trooper Holden that he got in touch with his dad. His dad agreed to contact an attorney. At that time, Trooper Holden advises Mr. Christensen that he only has a couple more minutes to contact an attorney because he's had more than half an hour. Mr. Christensen again explains that he's waiting for his dad to call back, that his dad agreed to contact an attorney, and that he's going to be helping him out. For the ensuing 5 minutes from 10:06 to 10:11, Mr. Christensen makes small talk while waiting to hear back from his dad. And then at 10:11, Trooper Holden terminates the contact time. He doesn't ask Mr. Christensen if he wants more time. He simply says, that's going to be enough. You have to make the decision now. Mr. Christensen then agrees to make a breath test advisory. Our argument in this case for the court is that in limiting the time or for the number of factors identified in prior decisions, this was a failure to vindicate Mr. Christensen's opportunity to contact counsel. First factor in favor of that is the time of day. Obviously, law offices are generally closed at 10 o'clock p.m., and so it's harder to facilitate contact with an attorney at that time, and so that allows greater latitude in trying to contact an attorney. Factor number two, and is outlined by this court's decision in Davis, a motorist can facilitate contact with an attorney through a third party. In that case, it was through a law clerk at a district court. In this case, it was Mr. Christensen's father. And Mr. Christensen's father, indeed in good faith, was trying to contact counsel, as it's shown in Exhibit 4, that he calls back with contact information for an attorney eventually. Now, the issue is whether or not Trooper Holden afforded sufficient time for Mr. Christensen and Mr. Christensen's father to try to get in touch with an attorney. Again, as I just outlined in the facts, Mr. Christensen was able to contact his father at 10:05, at 10:06, and Mr. Trooper Holden terminated that contact time 5 minutes later at 10:11. We would argue that that 5 minute stretch was an insufficient time, was not a vindication of Mr. Christensen's right.
If I may, Mr. Haska, but when we look at that, we don't just look at the 5 minutes, right? We are, and I'm just thinking about the district court's in its memorandum, when she looked at some factors and said these factors would lead Trooper Holden to believe the defendant was no longer making a continued good faith effort to reach an attorney during, which I think meant during those 5 minutes you just referred to. That was a factual finding. We would give deference to the district court on that factual finding, wouldn't we?
The factual finding that he was not making a good faith effort, that would be a factual finding, Your Honor. I would agree, but I do not believe that that factual finding is supported, that he's not making a good faith effort when immediately after he gets off his phone with his father. I believe that would be a clearly erroneous factual finding, that he said, I just got in touch with my dad. He's going to help me try to find an attorney. We have, you know, attorney contact friends. And there's a 5 minute pause in between, and that's it. I agree that that 5 minutes isn't looked at in isolation, but you also have to look at preceding that. For approximately 20 minutes, Mr. Christensen had been repeatedly trying to get in touch with people to get in touch with an attorney.
Well, I think the district court kind of looks at factors like, well, he was making small talk when he was informed that they would be moving on. He didn't ask for more time, didn't make additional efforts. I mean, there were several things the district court looked at, right? I just want to understand. So for us to follow your string of events, we would have to find that the district courts, we'd have to not find, but we'd have to conclude that the district court's finding that Trooper Holden believed that your client was no longer making a good faith effort was clearly erroneous, that there's not record support for it. Is that fair to say?
Your Honor, I guess I would disagree with that, because I believe that the factual record as a whole, that can be one factor, one finding that the court can or cannot, or whether it needs to reach that, whether that's clearly or erroneous or not, is separate. The issue is the total facts, the actual timeline of this is clearly established by the recording. And so once the facts are established, their meaning, their application is a conclusion of law that this court reviews de novo. And so I guess if the court thinks that one fact, that one finding is determinative, then I guess I would say that, yes, the court would have to find that that's clearly erroneous to side for defendant. But if the court were to conclude that that is but one fact, the district court's finding regarding Trooper Holden's subjective belief is but one fact in the factors considered for whether or not there is reasonable suspicion, no, I do not believe this court would need to find that to be clearly erroneous. It would just weigh that as one of the factors in the de novo review of whether or not there was a vindication of the right. Does that answer the question, Your Honor?
It helps frame the issue.
Okay. And so as I see my time is ticking down on this, I guess I would just outline that the number of factors in the Davis case, that there was clearly an intent to reach counsel, that there was an erroneous or there was a arbitrary deadline of 30 minutes established after the time period had already started. There was not a half an hour actually provided to Mr. Christensen, that, excluding the time of the reading of the advisory and everything else, it was closer to 22 minutes than anything that was provided. And so for the number of reasons outlined in our brief, we would argue that there was not a vindication of Mr. Christensen's right opportunity to contact with counsel. And at this time, I would yield and we'll save anything for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Hushka. Attorney for respondent, begin when you are ready. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Karen Scoyles. I'm an assistant city attorney for the City of Detroit Lakes. I represent respondent state of Minnesota. May it please the court, counsel. There are two issues on appeal in this matter, as Mr. Hushka has already identified. The state of Minnesota requests that this court affirm the lower court rulings on each of those issues. The first issue is whether or not or whether Trooper Holden's observations of appellant during a response to a burglary alarm call and the subsequent efforts to disable that alarm justified his seizure. And the district court found that the appellant's peculiar behavior when he had some contact with law enforcement, his inability to disable his own alarm, and the signs of impairment justified the trooper's seizure of appellant. And it is our request or position that this court affirm that finding. The facts in this case are similar to those in State of Minnesota versus Lopez, where the Kohl's employees called in about a person who was unconscious or passed out in their vehicle in the parking lot. The officer who responded with the lights on and seized the person or Ms. Lopez, and in the course of trying to discern whether or not she was all right, they made observations that she couldn't unlock her own door, she couldn't open her door, and those observations were justifiable, and that information or that evidence was admissible. Here, the Trooper Holden was responding to a burglary call, and the appellant keeps referring to it as a broken window call on pages 6 and 7, lines. My notes are upside down, I'm sorry. lines 10 through 13 and on page 7, lines 1 through 3, Trooper Holden testified that he was responding to a burglary call. The only people who have referred to it as a broken window call have been attorneys for Mr. Christensen. In any event, when the officers were responding to that, or the trooper was responding to that burglary call, he came in with the lights on because he was responding to a burglary call. When he arrived, there was the dark colored SUV parked in front of the garage door bay that was open. There was a person wrangling with two kegs in the back end of his vehicle. The vehicle was running. The alarm was sounding. They had contact with him when they asked him or tried to direct him to turn off or disable or cancel the alarm. He had difficulty doing that. He returned he went in the opposite direction from the garage door bay back to the kegs, had to be redirected to the garage door bay, and was not able to turn off the alarm despite telling the officers or troopers that he did have the knowledge, that he did have the code. He had to call other people. During the evidentiary hearing, Trooper Holden testified that fairly immediately he observed that appellant had an odor of alcohol and had bloodshot, watery eyes. That those observations, coupled with his inability to turn off his own alarm after a number of efforts, caused them to believe that he might be impaired. And that was all kind of happening contemporaneously with trying to discern whether or not there was a reason for the alarm to be going off and whether or not there was no longer a threat. If one reviews the squad car video, it's obvious from the actions of the other officers that it was not a concern that was immediately dispelled, as appellant argues. And so based upon that information, the district court found that appellant's peculiar behavior, his inability to disable his own alarm, and the other signs of impairment justified the seizure of appellant. And it's our position that there was nothing clearly erroneous about those findings, and there was nothing inappropriate about the court's application of those facts to established law, and that this court should affirm that finding. And if there are no questions about that issue, I would just as soon proceed to the question of whether or not the appellant's right to counsel was vindicated. And picking up that there aren't any, it's our position that Trooper Holden, or that Judge Carlson, having reviewed the having listened to the audio recording of the reading of the Minnesota breath test advisory and the conversations that Trooper Holden and appellant were having during the time when he perhaps could have been using the telephone and using the phone books that were available, that he being appellant, was not making a good faith effort to contact an attorney.
Ms. Goyles, if I can jump in here, and following up on Judge Jessen's questions earlier,
because I trust their quality.
The district court makes a finding about Holden's belief that there's no longer a good faith effort, right? So do you think that finding about the officer's, or the trooper, I should say, the trooper's subjective belief, is that in dispute? In other words, is appellant arguing that no, the testimony and the evidence in this record shows that Holden did not have that belief, that the district court was wrong? Is there a factual dispute on the district court's statement about Holden's belief here?
At the time of the hearing, I don't believe that was something that was disputed. There was a suggestion that the trooper should have waited for his father to call back once he finally contacted him, and that the 5 minutes that Trooper Holden gave to appellant was not reasonable. I don't think, I mean, the recording is clear. The appellant wasn't making any effort to use the phone, call anybody, or do anything other than wait and discuss with Trooper Holden where he lived, where he was from, whether he lived.
Ms. Coyles, I mean, but why isn't that reasonable? I mean, if he had just left a message for his father and said, please call me back, or he was hoping his dad would call him back, but where his father, as I understand it, had agreed to try and locate counsel, why would you reasonably expect him to then be trying to make other phone calls? I struggle with this. And I do understand in some cases talk about, well, you say you can rely on other people to do this, right? Isn't that correct? What he was doing?
I think that it could be distinguished from Davis from the standpoint that in Davis, the hour of the morning was about 3 o'clock a.m. Here it was about 10. The person doing the calling in Davis, or the trying to find additional information when the appellant there was nudged by the officer, they called the person doing the calling and got a busy signal. So I think that that's somewhat distinguishable. The other thing is that if when Trooper Holden asked or suggested to Mr. Christensen that the time had come to move along, I believe was his term, Mr. Christensen didn't ask for additional time, didn't say, could we give me a minute or two to see if my dad calls back? Could I please have the ability to make one more phone call to somebody in the book? I think that the recording.
On the other hand, it's like, so his father says he'll try and contact someone, and he's not even given 10 minutes. He's only given 5 minutes to try and do that. Right? Isn't that what happened here? I'm struggling with that. So anything you can do to help me with that, I'd appreciate.
I guess the district court found that the adult person here didn't do anything other than contact his relatives. And when asked by the trooper to maybe do some of his own calling, he did not. And when he was nudged along or asked to wrap it up or do something, he didn't ask for any additional time, and he didn't. The Trooper Holden did testify that had Mr. Christensen asked for additional time, he probably would have given it to him. But it didn't seem to Trooper Holden that Mr. Christensen was actively pursuing the efforts to contact a lawyer or to I guess he just felt that he had stopped trying.
Ms. Scoyles, do you remember the facts from Davis? As I look at the facts here, we have Mr. Christensen, who did attempt to call at least one attorney from the directory, and you have Trooper Holden making multiple attempts to encourage him to use the phone book and call an attorney on his own. Do you remember if there's anything analogous in the facts in Davis?
In Davis, I believe the person contacted a friend, got no response, contacted a paralegal friend who said that they would make the phone calls or try and find somebody for that person. And when the officer tried to move things along, the appellant there, Leto, I think was the name of the person, contacted the person again and the phone was busy and the officer was giving the Leto person a matter of minutes, not very long. So I think that the period of time here was longer than that given by the I think it was Mr. Leto in Davis. And I believe that the person that Mr. Leto, and I'm sorry if I'm giving that person a sex change, that person asked for additional time to for the callback, and they the officer there arbitrarily closed the window, whereas here Trooper Holden construed that Mr. Christensen was done trying and was just waiting. And I see that my time is running. And so if nobody else has any questions, I would reiterate that from the state's perspective, the facts here are more like those in Palm rather than in Davis, where Mr. Christensen was waiting for his family to contact a lawyer for him and was not actively engaged in the effort to find a lawyer to secure advice that Trooper Holden's giving or providing of the phone and the phone books and the urging to actually do something to contact an attorney. Those the findings made by Judge Carlson were not clearly erroneous and the law consistent with Palm shows that it was also not inappropriate, and I'd ask that this court affirm the court's ruling below. And I guess the other thing is that if the court does not affirm the ruling below with respect to giving the appellants sufficient time, I think the remedy is suppression of the test result and not necessarily the dismissal of the under the influence count. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have time for rebuttal now. Please begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to begin briefly with the seizure issue and specifically something by Ms. Scoyles saying that there's nothing in the record regarding a broken window. And I'm quoting from page 2 of the addendum. This is the district court's order and findings, quote, on October 30th, 2019, the Minnesota State Patrol and Detroit Lakes Police Department were dispatched to an alarm and reports of a broken window at Beverage Wholesalers in Detroit Lakes, end quote. And so again, this is a factual finding made by the district court that it was a report of a broken window at Beverage Wholesalers. This is confirmed by Trooper Holden's testimony at page 20 to 21 of the transcript in this. So this is not something that is just being put forth by Mr. Christensen's counsel. This is an actual factual finding made by the district court, confirmed by the testimony of Trooper Holden. So it was a broken window report that he was dispatched to, the alarm, and that again, it was confirmed that there were no broken windows at the scene when he arrived. So I think those facts are important for the court to know and to note as it construes the dispelling of any reasonable suspicion at the time of the seizure. And again, we are just focusing on the initial seizure. We're not disputing for purposes of this appeal whether or not the seizure was properly expanded or whether or not there was grounds to expand any seizure. We're just disputing whether or not the initial seizure was lawful, and we believe that it was not because of the dispelling of any reasonable suspicion. Now, as it relates to the attorney contact time in this case, another factor that has not been brought up by either party is the overall time frame of how this all happened. Again, the initial dispatch of Trooper Holden was at 9:22 p.m., and attorney contact time was terminated at 10:11, less than an hour after the whole call or the whole situation happened. That is another factor that this court is supposed to consider, is whether or not the time from when the driving conduct happened versus when the test was, and whether there's a need, whether the dissipation of alcohol in the bloodstream is potentially dissipating to the extent or affect the test. under an hour from a response call to taking a test is well less than what many of the cases that this court have considered are, where you're talking about arrests way out in the country and hours traveling back to law enforcement centers and still affording, you know, time to allow. And so again, the overall time frame of how this all happened also weighs in favor of Mr. Christensen in this case. And I think Judge Jessen hit the nail on the head. You know, essentially what it is whether or not it was reasonable for Trooper Holden to afford Mr. Christensen less than 5 minutes after his dad had agreed to facilitate contact with an attorney. And Trooper Holden knew that that call had been made, that that agreement had been struck, and yet he terminated it less than 5 minutes after. To again bring home the point, I don't know what else would be reasonable for Mr. Christensen to do in this case. If he repeatedly calls back his dad within that 5 minutes, his dad can't try to contact an attorney if he's on the phone with Mr. Christensen constantly. If he's getting barraged with calls, he cannot reach out to third parties, to third party counsel, to facilitate that contact. It was entirely reasonable for Mr. Christensen, after his dad agreed to make this contact, to wait for at least 5 minutes.
Couldn't he say to the trooper, it's only been a few minutes?
Your Honor,
can I call him back? Can we wait another five? Can we give him 10 minutes? Couldn't he have also just called an attorney himself?
Your Honor, he could have made a statement such as that, but that, I think, ignores exactly what Trooper Holden said when he terminated the time. He didn't say, okay, if I don't hear back from dad, we haven't heard back from dad, I think we're going to have to wrap this up. He said, your time is done. He terminated the time. At that point, Trooper Holden had given an order that this time is done. As the court is well aware, it's illegal for an arrestee to disagree with the lawful order of the officer. The officer had said, your time is done at this point, not, okay, you need to call your dad and you need to try to figure this out. He was told that your time is done. I think we're creating a dangerous situation if after a motorist is told your time is done, he tries to negotiate, he tries to barter for additional time, because the courts and the officer itself could see that bartering is not agreeing to take a test. And I think we're creating a rabbit hole if we're saying that a motorist has to negotiate for additional time after he's told that his time is done. Simply stated, and as we say in our reply brief, Your Honor, I don't think there's any way for this court to find that Mr. Christensen was afforded a reasonable amount of time absent overturning Davis. And simply stated, Ms. Scoyles and the state or in the city have not identified any basis for overturning Davis in this case. And for that reason alone, Your Honor, we believe that the court should overturn the district court decision. I see I'm down to less than 10 seconds, so if there are no additional questions, I will yield my time.
Mr. Hushkoff. Thank you both again for your helpful arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement. And